The issues that matter most, right here. The Drew Mariani Show
on Relevant Radio.
The Newsom administration calls this legislation historic, but it is also controversial.
The housing crisis is an issue so large that there is no single solution.
State Senate President Pro Tem and San Diegan Tony Adkins says part of the solution is Senate Bill 9, legislation she sponsored, which will increase housing density in areas now zoned for single-family homes. Under SB 9, a property owner could split their lot into two separate lots, each required to be at least 1,200 square feet, and build a two-residence duplex home on each half. So in place of the one original home, there would now be up to four. Critics of the legislation say it will not create more affordable housing as it intends to, but instead change the character of existing communities.
The Drew Mariani Show on Relevant Radio.
Yeah, good afternoon. That was a report from CBS San Diego. 2 days after surviving his recall attempt, Governor Newsom signed groundbreaking new legislation that he said will address the state's housing crisis. And we know that California is certainly dealing with one of those. I'll bring you up to speed on all of it. It's good to be with you today. I'm Drew Mariani. Thanks for being here. Thanks for hanging out with me. You know, these bills, now state law, they pave the way for what they call upzoning, with traditionally single-family neighborhoods allowing the creation of more than one housing unit. Now, if you live in the state of California, you may not. You might say, I really don't get what you're talking about, Drew. Maybe you're in California, you decided that with the prospect of a family coming, that one-bedroom apartment in the city isn't going to cut it, so you try to build a house in the burbs. Well, you might be out of luck. Just after the recall election, the governor signed this bill, and it requires towns. It allows their towns to allot lots to be subdivided. So lawns are just 4 feet. So, I mean, imagine that. Imagine what that's going to do for housing. According to the Daily Wire, each of the subdivided lots could have two units, such as a duplex, on them. The law also doesn't allow the towns to require that driveways be large enough for two cars. So it would basically turn the suburbs into the city, just making it, you know, much, much denser housing, and it's not going to go over well. Does it surprise you that Governor Newsom waited until after the recall election in order to sign that bill? I know a lot of people are disenchanted with it. There's no question about it, but we'll continue to monitor it and bring you up to speed, because I know it does affect a lot of people. I have my wife has a cousin who lives in California. When he moved out there 15 years ago, he bought a townhouse or a condo with two bedrooms or something. He got married then, and then he had a wife, and then he had two more children. I just don't know how Californians, I don't know how you can afford the cost of living out there. And we know that rent is going through the roof right now as well, because people can't afford housing, and we're seeing an exodus from the state. A lot of people are moving to Texas, to Arizona, to Tennessee, to Florida, to other states where housing is a little bit more affordable and taxes certainly a lot lower. Maggie, I know you're moving. You're getting ready to go down to the Chicago area. Maggie, of course, is my producer here. She was looking for housing, and
I am.
She was here the other night with her mother, who prayed the chaplet with us. And you went to your first football game at Lambeau Field, right?
I did. Yeah, I've seen it. I've been like in tours around Lambeau, but I had never had a chance to go to a game.
Legendary field. It really is. I mean, I grew up in Philadelphia or outside of it, and rooted the Eagles most of my life. And then when I joined the network here, it's, you know, you're in cities all across the country, so you could root for everyone from Chicago to Los Angeles to the Packers. But there's nothing like that Green Bay Packer franchise, let alone the stadium. Tell me what your first experience was like last night, going to an NFL game after the pandemic, because this is the first time they've allowed people back in. What was it like, and what was the experience like?
I rushed there after broadcast. You knew that, and I met up with mom. The only hotel room that was available in the city was a Motel 6 that we got.
Oh, wow.
And,
charming.
Yeah. Oh yeah. It was lovely. And we ate a couple sandwiches really quick, and we hopped the commuter bus that takes you from the hotel to Lambeau, and
wow,
there was such a buzz in the air. Everyone, just all the conversations around us were so glad to be back. We missed this so much. And to be honest, like when the singer started singing the national anthem, and everyone had their hands on their heart, and everyone around us was just like singing so loud. And they have, you know, when they say the bombs bursting in air, they like send fireworks up, and then the fighter jet flies over. And like my mom and I looked at each other, and we were just like had tears in our eyes, and we were like, wow, we really love this. We love this country. We love this freedom. Like it was just, it was really awesome.
That is cool when those jets zoom over. And Monday night, you chose a great game to go to.
Yeah.
If you're a Detroit fan, not so great.
Yeah.
Because when the game opened after Green Bay got destroyed last week by the Saints, I thought, oh, man, Aaron Rodgers looking a little rusty. I wonder if this is going to be a good year for the Green Bay Packers.
Yeah, but, the first quarter, too, we were like, oh, no, is this just going to be a repeat of last week? But then they pulled through. It was good.
They lit it up. I think Rodgers threw four touchdowns last night. I watched the Monday night game. Mm-hmm. I looked for you. I didn't see you there in the stands. But
too bad.
It's exciting. It's fun. I've been to more, I guess, games in Lambeau than I've been in any other stadium around the country. And it's an experience. And if you have never been there, I would suggest you take the tour and
highly recommend
then go to a game. Well, glad you enjoyed it, Maggie.
Yeah.
I'm glad your mom was here. And
yeah, me too.
I don't know whether by moving to Chicago you're going to become a Bear fan.
Oh, heck no. Heck no. I did tell someone recently that I might be amiable to being a Cubs fan.
Well,
so
there you go.
We'll see about that.
The thing about the Bears, which I just love, I mean, I love Virginia McCaskey, who is the owner of the Bears. I think she's 97 years old. I saw her, I think they showed a shot of her one of the games over the weekend. And she's a huge fan of Relevant Radio.
She is,
a great, great supporter of Relevant Radio. So it's like, how do you root against you know, somebody like Virginia? You know, she has these rosary beads that are Bear colors. And
it's so sweet.
She is sweet. Now, she's a wonderful lady. And yeah, you know, when you're in a lot of different cities, it's kind of fun to run for those teams that we broadcast in. But anyway, we got a lot to get into today, and I hope you will stay with us. Want to share some other news that we've been following here. One of the stories, and again, if you tune into the broadcast here, you know, you're going to see that we are getting you plugged into events sometimes before the mainstream media gets to those issues, or you'll see what we say is true. Right. When you tune into this program, I try to give you a very honest look at life. And I just saw a story, something I spoke about probably at least a year ago or more. And I said, you know, I'll share this with everyone. There was a story you might have heard about last week where a guy threw a bomb into a Minneapolis suburb mosque, and he got convicted and he got jailed. The man who did it is a guy named Michael Harry. Right. And he claims now that he's actually Emily Claire Harry. So the news media all reported him as Emily Claire. But the judge tried him instead as Michael Harry. Right. So now he wants the judge to legally recognize him as Emily Claire and send him to a woman's federal prison. Instead of being a man, he's Michael Harry, and going to a male prison, like most male prisoners do. This is something I spoke about. This is the confusion that's bred by bad policy, by this transgender ideology that's now being, you know, it's shoved down the throats of your children in their schools, you know, coming across their televisions. And we're seeing it in sports. Now we're seeing it in the federal judicial system. I had warned about this. I said, you know, there's going to be a lot of guys who don't want to do life in jail where they can get beat up or be around a bunch of dudes. They might want to go to a female prison where they can be in a relationship. The threat of violence may not be there. It'd be a totally different environment. Why not just say you identify as Emily Claire as opposed to who you really are, Michael Harry, right? That's what this guy did. I'm Emily Claire. And he wants a judge to recognize him. So the Biden administration, they're now considering a new policy to house inmates in federal prisons based on how they identify. So if Michael says, I'm Emily, and he self-identifies as Emily rather than his biological sex, then we might see this. California is already doing this, but if the Biden administration comes through and you're in prison and you got a long run, you know, there might be a change in your future. And I said, this is going to happen. Why not, right? So the Justice Department right now is reviewing the policies on transgender inmates, and we'll see if they come up with a definitive law. But here's a little bit more on this story from CBS and why the policy is actually even being considered.
Justice Department official says the department is reviewing its policies on housing transgender inmates in the federal prison system. Protections for transgender prisoners were rolled back in the Trump administration, but the Federal Bureau of Prisons policies for transgender inmates are in the spotlight after a leader of an Illinois anti-government militia group who identifies as transgender was sentenced this week to 53 years in prison. Now it's up to a Bureau Council of Psychology and Correctional Officials to decide where to house the militia group leader.
Yeah, so can you imagine the confusion that will come from this? This is an experiment. This is a national experiment. Can you imagine if a female inmate says, you know, I don't want to be with all these females. I'm a guy, identifies as a male, and, you know, Emily decides, you know, to be John or whatever, goes to a male prison. What happens if she ends up pregnant? What do you do then? What do you do with the kid? I mean, does anybody think about the consequences of this interchange? Of the acts of violence, perhaps, against women in the prison, where, you know, as an institution, you have an obligation to keep them safe. I mean, it's just a mess. I was sharing with Maggie before the broadcast that Mayor Lightfoot, the mayor of Chicago, is talking about funding her police department, right? There's all this talk of defunding the police, right? Take a look at these liberal policies and what ultimately happens. They're a mess. You see what's happening on the border. You see what's happening with mandates. You're seeing what's happening here with this transgender ideology. You see what happens when there's talk of defunding police. Does that make sense to you? You know, in the long run, you know, you can make a case for it. I know a lot of people tried to do that, but I think the proof's in the pudding. So now, what's she doing? She's going to increase the budget for law enforcement. A lot of violence in the streets of Chicago, and it's a beautiful city. It's a great town. You know, I love it. One of my favorite cities. But that's what happens. And we're seeing it, as I said, these are experiments, and the experiments just are not panning out well. You know, the U.S. has announced, speaking of mandates and vaccines, they're going to expect foreign travelers to be vaccinated against COVID-19 in order to come into the country, right? So CBS News reported that under the new policy, which began in November, foreign nationals that fly into the United States, they have to be fully vaccinated and show proof of vaccination before even boarding the plane. And they're going to have a negative COVID test within 3 days of traveling. You know, I was down in Mexico earlier in the year. And, you know, in order to come back to the States, everybody that was with me, I was on a pilgrimage down there. There was, I don't know, 50 of us or 40 of us, something, whatever the number was. We all had to be COVID tested. It cost us money to do it. We had to pay. I had my wife with me. I mean, you had to pay for whoever was with you. And then if you did not pass that test, you ended up having to stay in that country another couple of weeks. And that's what happened to a guy I know who's in Italy and some other places. So that's the policy. If you want to come to the States, you got to be vaccinated. You also have to obtain a negative COVID test 3 days before traveling. However, the policy doesn't seem to apply, does it, to people who are coming across our southern border or our northern border. It's just the way we're seeing it. You know, the White House press, they had a press conference yesterday, and Jen Psaki announced that the administration will be requiring foreign nationals to, you know, traveling to the U.S. to be fully vaccinated. That's what she said. So there was a reporter there, and he asked, just for clarification, on whether or not the same requirement is being asked of those who cross the southern border, who come across our border. Listen to the exchange.
What's going on at the border? Is somebody asking the foreign nationals who are walking into Del Rio, Texas, and setting up camps on this side of the border for proof of vaccination or a negative COVID test?
Well, first of all, I can readdress for you or re-talk you through what steps we take.
That is the policy for people who fly into the country. So if somebody walks into the country right across the river, does somebody ask them to see their vaccination card?
Well, let me explain to you again, Peter, how our process works. As individuals come across the border, and they are both assessed for whether they have any symptoms. If they have symptoms, the intention is for them to be quarantined. That is our process. They're not intending to stay here for a lengthy period of time. I don't think it's the same thing. It's not the same thing. These are individuals, as we've noted and as we've been discussed, we are expelling individuals based on Title 42. Specifically because of COVID, because we want to prevent a scenario where large numbers of people are gathering, posing a threat to the community and also to the migrants themselves. So those are the policies that we put in place, in large part because, again, the CDC continues to recommend Title 42 be in place, given we're facing a global pandemic.
Yeah, I just love that exchange. The key line that struck me in that, this is the White House press secretary, they're only staying for a limited time. Yeah, well, when I go to Mexico, I'm only there for a limited time, a couple of days, a week, 2 weeks, right? These people are crossing the border unvaccinated. I had heard, you know, I felt bad for a lot of the Haitians. I mean, the poor Haitians, they come from the poorest nation in the Western Hemisphere. A lot of them, believe it or not, were living in other countries. They were in Colombia and Nicaragua and Brazil and different places like that. So they have Haitian descent. They come to the States, they identify as Haitian, they return to Haiti. And they say, well, what am I going to do now? I have no money. You know, they're now stuck in this impoverished nation. 25% of those who have illegally crossed the border are being deported. 75% are either being processed or let in. And, you know, we're dealing with a pretty significant population that, you know, I have concern about COVID and things along those lines. I think it's a legitimate question. If you want to come into this country, you have to have your vaccination card or you have to have your COVID test, but you can cross the southern border. I mean, what a mess. And another policy down there that just has gotten out of control. When you had, over the weekend, 12,000 migrants coming to the southern border. Mexico wants nothing to do with it anymore. You know, Mexico's not stopping them from coming over. The southern border of Mexico, there was a policy in place that prevented people from coming up from Central America. Not anymore. And we're just seeing this deluge of individuals. My heart goes out to them, and we're going to talk possibly in a few minutes just about the immigration crisis on the border. It's a tough situation, and my heart goes out to these men and women who have a lot less than you, a lot less than me, and are just looking for a better way of life. But at the same time, we as a nation have due process, we have law, and we have that rule of law, and people should follow. You know who's really getting the short end of the stick on this? It's the people who are doing it the right way. They're signing up, they're getting their green cards, they're going through the process, and they're watching a lot of other people jump to the front of the line, cross the border, and get shipped to different parts of the country. So it's a mess. It really is. It's a mess. Let me take a call or two very quickly here. 888-914-9149. Talking about a lot of different headlines in the news today. RJ is listening in the Bay Area in California. RJ, good afternoon.
Yes, hi. Thank you for taking my call. I really like your program.
Thanks.
I've been around quite a bit, and I'm pushing 80, so I'm settled down now, but... The thing I wanted to say about these guys into the women's prisons, the women have gang. I know a little bit about the women's and the men's prisons, mm-hmm. but these guys will get their, you know, kicked.
Yeah.
Every time they try and.
Hey, RJ, I hate to do this to you. We've got a really bad connection because you're breaking up. I'm hearing about every third word. So
I'm sorry.
No problem. You can try it again. You sound a little clearer, but if we don't have the connection, we'll have to reconnect, but go right ahead.
Okay. Thank you.
Yeah, go ahead, RJ. I'll let you try again. All right. You know, guys, do me a favor. If you can just check on his signal, interesting comment there. He has a lot of experience, understands both male and female prisons, and love to get his take. Let me give you one final thought just on the border crisis, and then we've got a lot to dive into today here too. I would ask you to be as prayerful as you can for those who are coming over. You should thank God for the blessings he's given you in your life. And I think we need to pray for those who've been given the authority to make these types of decisions. There is a crisis on our southern border with Mexico right now, where tens of thousands of migrants have have gathered, and I'm sure you've probably seen the video. You know, one report somebody was just telling me there were up to 14,000 people sheltering under the bridge, and there was no sanitation, no running water. People were using whatever they could to protect themselves from the sun. You know, they were using trash bags and leaves and sticks. And the Border Patrol's begun sending back hundreds of these. I said mostly Haitians. You know, they're flying them back. A lot of people have fled a very desperate situation. And, you know, in the days ahead, I do want to look at it because it's a major issue that affects our country. And as Christians, I think we need to approach this with a very compassionate and loving heart. According to some reports, there are still some caravans coming up through Mexico. And it's not clear at this point whether or not those reports of deportation are convinced people to turn back or not. We have not seen the vice president at all. I'm curious as to where she is. I thought she was put in charge of the crisis here in the southern border. And I do find the optics of it kind of telling. I mean, she's been very separated from all of the events that we've seen just recently. You know, the Afghanistan withdrawal, the crisis on our southern border, so many of these other issues. And I think there's a reason for that. I do. I do think we're going to see that. I don't know whether Joe Biden will finish all 4 years of his term. I pray he will. I pray he stays sharp and is able to lead. But it's more than likely if he doesn't, there's always the 25th Amendment that can be executed if there's concern about his mental capabilities or who knows, any other reason. God could even call him home. Then you would have the vice president here. And if she was to run again in 2024, she can really disavow association with some of these policies. And again, there's no video of her there on the southern border or dealing with a lot of these issues. Whether or not the Democratic Party would run her in 2024, that is left to be seen. But I'll tell you what, let me try RJ one last time. If I can't get him, I'll take a quick break, and I've got other news for you too. RJ, welcome back. Thanks for your patience, sir.
Yes, my comment was, if these guys think that they could get into a woman's prison and come out safely, they're mistaken, because I've been around a little bit, and I know a little bit about women's and men's prisons.
Yeah.
And I'm almost 80 now, so yeah. I've settled down. They have gangs in there just like the men's prisons, and those guys won't get away with much. Wow. They'll be lucky to come out of there.
So you think the women would take care of the women if these guys...
They'll take care of themselves, yeah.
That's fascinating. I don't know much about women's prison. I've been to a male prison before several times just to visit somebody I knew there, but... it can be a rough place, and you're right, they have their own code, so to speak. Interesting insight.
It is really rough, both sides, you know. Of course, we're you know, we got the power, but they also know how to handle things. So.
Yeah. Hey, RJ, thanks for the perspective. I appreciate it. I really appreciate it.
I hope this doesn't happen, because that's really sad, you know, that these guys, these weirdos, you know.
Yeah,
so, okay, that's my comment.
Thank you, RJ. I appreciate it, brother. Good to hear from you. Yeah, I hope it doesn't happen, too. It doesn't make sense. Again, let's just zoom out and look at this thing objectively. I mean, will any good come from this? No. You know, absolutely not, right? But based on all the dysfunction we're seeing on so many different levels of government and society right now, it's very likely. It is very, very likely that this might happen. Let me sneak Dee Dee in Phoenix, Arizona very quickly. Dee Dee, good afternoon. Welcome.
Hi, Drew. The reason I'm calling is at this time, there are so many people that are angry about what's going on at the border, but I applaud the fact that you have such an open heart to at least looking at this issue, addressing it, and providing information to your listeners. Perhaps the truth will soften their hearts.
Yeah. Well, I appreciate you saying that, Dee Dee. I hope so. I mean, look, these are our brothers. These are our sisters, right? And we are a brother's keeper. We have to show compassion, love, and mercy. That's always my first approach. At the same time, that's what makes this issue so difficult for me. When it comes to immigration, it's one of the more difficult issues I have to grapple with, because I also believe in a nation's sovereign right to control its borders, to protect its citizenry. And there is a rule of law that, you know, we put in place for people to come in. So it can get very, very difficult. That's why I say let's pray for that clarity, and that those who are given the noble charge of handling these issues, they'll do it with prudence and justice and profound wisdom. I'm going to take a short pause. When we come back, more news for you. You know, there is talk. There's been a commission established by the Biden administration to look into the Supreme Court and possibly expand it, right? Today is the anniversary of the death of Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg. She died on this day, September. Well, I guess she died September 18th. She died back in 2020, a couple days ago. I don't know why I thought today was it. But I want to take a look today at the future of the Supreme Court. There's a huge case coming to, and there's a huge vote coming up this Friday that could possibly open the doors for the end of Roe v. Wade. So the battle is about to begin. Stay with me. I'll unpack that for you and more.
Your news. The Drew Mariani Show on Relevant Radio. Your news now.
Catholic Order of Foresters is proud to sponsor the Relevant Radio studio line. For information about employment opportunities and flexible premium life insurance plans, visit relevantradio.com/Forester.
If you're not worried about the term limits, what are you worried about?
Well, what was the other? You mentioned
adding the number, changing the number of justices.
Oh, yes, yes. There is no fixed number in the Constitution, so this court has had as few as 5, as many as 10. 9 seems to be a good number, and it's been that way for a long time. I have heard that there are some people on the Democratic side who would like to increase the number of judges. I think that was a bad idea when President Franklin Delano Roosevelt tried to pack the court. If that plan had been effective, the court's number would have swelled immediately from 9 to 15, and the president would have 6 appointments. Well, if anything would make the court appear partisan, it would be that. One side saying, when we're in power, we're going to enlarge the number, so we will have more people who will vote the way we want them to. So I am not at all in favor of that solution to what I see as a temporary situation.
The Drew Mariani Show on Relevant Radio.
Yeah, that was Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg back in 2019. She did an interview with NPR and talked about her concerns regarding packing the Supreme Court. And we should remember her soul. She entered her eternal reward a year ago. I think it was the 18th that she died. That, of course, allowed the president to select a third candidate for the Supreme Court, and he chose a Notre Dame law professor by the name of Amy Coney Barrett. You probably remember the confirmation hearings on that. Wow. They were something else. It didn't sit well with a lot of liberals, and she was just absolutely composed and amazing. So with the defeat of Donald Trump and the taking over of now the House and really the Senate, they're looking for ways to change the court. So after the Supreme Court decided to take up the Dobbs abortion case from Mississippi, this is a huge case, by the way, a case that will very likely overturn Roe v. Wade. So this is the case that a lot of liberals are freaking out about, to be honest with you. They got very upset because they knew that their secret weapon for getting their way was no longer going to work with them. And then they, then we had the case of the Texas abortion law, right? When that came before the court with a request for an emergency stay, what happened? You know how it panned out. You know how apoplectic now the left is when it comes to abortion. They couldn't do anything about it because of how the law was written. And that really angered the left. So there's now a commission looking into whether or not they should add more justices to the court. Now, President Biden said this after he was inaugurated. You know, he said, hey, I'm going to expand the, he didn't say he was going to expand, he was going to set up this commission to look at the pros and the cons of that. Should he expand it to, let's say, 13 justices rather than 9? When you do that, when you add justices, because you don't like the composition of the court right now, because it tends to, if you look at it, maybe lean a little bit more conservatively. And again, the fear of you know, Roe somehow going away. I mean, that's the high holy sacrament for the culture of death. I mean, you just cannot take abortion away, and they'll do anything. And that's why I'll be surprised if the Biden administration doesn't come out and really consider, maybe even make a case for expanding the court to 13 rather than 9. Although you have very liberal justices like Ruth Bader Ginsburg, Justice Breyer even said the same thing. You know, that he doesn't think he's not going to step down, right? He doesn't think the court should be expanded either. Court packing. It's something that a former president tried. Franklin Roosevelt tried to do it when he couldn't get his way. And, of course, it failed. And you probably know the history of that. We've spoken about this in the past. But on top of it, some of the Democrats right now have been trying to force Stephen Breyer to retire. They're figuring, okay, if we're not going to expand the court to 13, let's get him out. You know, if Ginsburg would have, you know, stepped down and retired rather than staying on the court, then things could have been, you know, radically different, right, under Obama. But that's not the case, right? So now they're saying, we don't want to make that mistake again. We need Stephen Breyer to step down. He's fairly old. The Democrats don't want to end up in a situation with, you know, like what happened with Ginsburg. And she died when a Republican president and Republicans controlled the Senate. So what does the future of the court look like? What are some of the huge cases? And what are we going to see? This third branch of government is critical, and a lot of polling has been done on it, too. I think people look at it more like a political arm, and I don't think it should be viewed like that at all. But I've invited chief counsel for the Judicial Crisis Network and a former clerk for Justice Clarence Thomas to join us today. And it's a delight to have with us Carrie Severino. Thank you for your time. Always good to have you back. Good afternoon.
It's great to be here, Drew.
So this is a developing story. You know, it's one that I think we will certainly be talking about in greater detail in the days ahead. Have you heard anything? You getting any vibe on what's happening with this commission yet, the size the court should be, what they're finding? Or is that still pretty much silent and invisible?
Well, that is the thing. The commission really puts the deliberations that they're going on at this effectively behind the scenes and behind closed doors. They do have some public meetings, there's some Zoom meetings they've had, but really, I think the challenge here is the commission. Look, they're not going to be coming up with a result that is simply a neutral. Oh, it's clear from legal scholars that such and such number of justices is the ideal justice number on the court. It isn't a number. I think as Justice Ginsburg was pointing out in those comments, that's in the Constitution. You could have any number of justices in theory. The problem here isn't, is 9 a great number? Is 13 a good number? It's the way that it's being done. This is being proposed as a purely partisan move. And that's why you're getting, again, even people as diverse as Ruth Bader Ginsburg and Justice Breyer, both very liberal members of the court. And then obviously the conservative members of the court recently have also spoken out about this as well. It is something that would be very bad for the court if it's done in a partisan way. This commission the president has put together, from my perspective, I see it really as just kind of a fig leaf to cover up the inherently political nature of this debate. Changing the size of the court for political ends is something that President Biden has long stood against, but then when suddenly it became clear that that was the direction the party was moving and that was the direction they were, that his deep-pocketed donors were going to be asking him to do, he switched. And so he said, well, I'm just going to have a commission that will give me its insights. This is a commission that if you look at the members, it's very clear. It's heavily, heavily weighted with far-left members on this commission. And ultimately, I think they're going to come to whatever conclusion those same liberal dark money groups want, and which is really, we want the court to be in the power of the left and not be a neutral arbiter of justice.
Yeah, it's such a good point. I think you're absolutely correct. I mean, let's talk about Justice Breyer for a moment. I think he's 83 years of age. Mm-hmm. They want him to step down and retire. Why didn't Ruth Bader Ginsburg retire when Obama was still president? She had all those health problems. She was in and out of the hospital all the time. And there was, a likelihood, there could be a Republican president. And probably unlikely in her mind because it looked like, Hillary was certainly going to win that. But your thoughts on that and this call to ask justices to step down. I mean, I think a lot of people are looking at them more like a political entity than they are, a judicial entity.
Oh, absolutely. And all the arguments for him stepping down are just outright political. I think Ginsburg did not step down for a few reasons. One, she was really the leader of the liberal wing of the court. I think she enjoyed having that opportunity for leadership. Yes, she had cancer at the time, but boy, this is some woman who was incredibly strong, beat cancer multiple times, already in her life. And, you know, I worked all the way through, and I went through cancer myself recently, and, wow. and going, and it gave me just a newfound appreciation. She's working through chemo, didn't even tell anyone, and she's this really high stakes job. So I think she felt like, you know what, I'm handling this well enough. I can do this. I think she probably also was hoping when she, during the Obama era, everyone was suspecting Hillary Clinton was going to be the next president. I think for her, a path-breaking woman on the court, she thought, well, wouldn't it be great to have a woman, the first woman president, appoint my successor? So maybe that factored in. I think at the end of the day, just, you know, it's a very hard job to step away from it because it becomes so caught up in everything that you're doing. And you know, I think that's a fair choice for her to make. Everyone has to make that choice themselves of when they retire.
And here's the thing. She loved her work. You know, I may not have agreed with, you know, how she sided on certain issues, but I know how much I love my work. I'd like to do it as long as I possibly can. You probably feel the same way. And it probably gave her life to be able to continue to do this. Her mind was still incredibly sharp. You know, Justice Amy Coney Barrett, she gave a speech at in Kentucky at a dinner hosted by Senator Minority Leader Mitch McConnell. And she was concerned, Carrie, about the appearance of partisanship in the court. I like your assessment. Is she right to be concerned about that? Did you get that vibe? What do you say?
Well, yeah, I think it's fair to be concerned about the appearance of partisanship, because one of the things she expressed concern about is the way people paint and talk about the court. So she was frustrated because she said, look, when we come to conclusions, everyone just writes and says, well, you're just doing this because your politics or this or that. That's really what you're saying is I disagree with the results or with the way you got to it. But that's different than saying you're doing it for political reasons. And that's not to say that I can't speak to what some of the justices are doing. I think, unfortunately, some of the justices do have methods of interpretation that kind of invite you to bring your own your own preferences and policy preferences in. If you think the Constitution's evolving, for example, how are you supposed to be able to tell which way it should evolve except for to kind of consult your own, where do I think it should evolve? If, however, like Barrett and like the conservative members of the court, you believe that you have to interpret the law as it's written, as it was originally meant, then your personal politics aren't part of it. So to say, well, you just came to that result because of politics, that's not fair. And I think that's what's so frustrating. And Justice Thomas recently at a speech at Notre Dame said something similar. It's like, look, guys, look at what we're doing here. We're interpreting the language. That just because you came to a different conclusion doesn't make it political.
That's so true. Yeah, I actually watched that earlier today, that address he gave to Notre Dame. I was listening to it earlier in the afternoon. Just explain something to me, make sure I'm clear on this. If a bill was to come to the Senate, right, that would expand the court, do they need to get 60 votes or just a simple majority? How does that work?
Well, currently, any legislative action by the Senate does have to pass what's called cloture. Cloture means basically the debate ends. So the bill passes with 51 votes, but the Senate can't end its debate on the bill unless they get at least 60 votes. And so in order for the Senate to move forward on it, you would need at least 60 votes. Now, there are some people on the left for a host of different reasons. Court packing is one of them, but they also want to have talked about, let's add states to the union, let's make D.C. a state, let's make Puerto Rico a state. There are other kind of really big asks the left wants that they know they can't get 60 votes to move ahead on, that they want to say, hey, let's just eliminate that. Let's just go to everything is 51 votes. I think that's a real mistake because it would allow the Senate, which thus far has been some kind of brakes on the just whiplash partisanship that can happen in office, to it would really mean that that check isn't there. So for these major pieces of legislation, you wouldn't have any need to have any compromise, have any across the board agreement that brings in the other party at all. And I think it would set our government up for a real even more partisan flip flopping than we already have. And that would, you know, that's saying a lot.
I just wonder what it would do to the mindsets of the justices. I'm assuming they interpret the law as they see it and through that prism. But if Congress did add all those members, for some unlikely reason, it gets through. I don't think it would happen. But I look at a guy like Chief Justice Roberts, and I wonder if he'd stop acting like a conciliator and become maybe more of a conservative. Do you think people would begin to dig their heels into a particular camp a little bit more in terms of the way they view and interpret things?
Well, I think it would make them very, it would dramatically shift the way the court works. So first of all, you know, it almost wouldn't matter what Chief Justice Roberts decided to do at that point, because the whole purpose of these proposals is to add enough justices to shift the balance of the court. So they, again, just like the people who are saying, let's get rid of the filibuster for legislation in the Senate, it's saying, hey, we don't want any cases that we have anything less than a guaranteed outcome for our side on. So they would, instead, you know, President Trump got to appoint three justices. They want to add four more justices. So outweigh all of those plus one. And it would mean that there would be a clear majority in any case of Democratic appointees, and who, you know, historically all share exactly the same very liberal approach to interpreting the Constitution. I think that would be it would make the court even more, I think, partisan. It's hard to imagine how they would continue to function, especially because, you know, what would happen next? Eventually, Republicans would then gain power again. And it's hard to imagine they wouldn't then also say, okay, you know, you added four justices, now we're going to add four justices. Okay, now we're up to, what, 17 justices on the Supreme Court. Right, we're building an extra wing onto the building. And it would just go back and forth. This would be a horrible thing for our Constitution and for our country.
That's the slippery slope. And that's another reason why I think the existing justices recognize that and are saying, hey, nine seems to be a pretty good number. Seems to work pretty well. So, hey, Kerry, thank you. I appreciate you being with us today. Always great to hear with you. I know the Supreme Court is set to hear a very big abortion case coming up. Jackson Women's Health, particular case. What do you think is going to happen with Roe v. Wade? Very quickly, I have probably about a minute left. Do you think a case will come before the court that's going to finally flip Roe v. Wade, overturn it?
You know, I think there's a real chance. We still don't know. We'll know more on December 1st when we hear the oral arguments. But I think, you know, this court packing is just part of a campaign of trying to intimidate and threaten the justices, because everyone knows they don't want it. I think we're going to see that kind of intimidation and threats continue, especially with this case, because there's always fear-mongering, always misconceptions about the cases being put out there to try to intimidate the justices away from doing what they know the Constitution requires.
Well, we'll talk more. Hey, thank you very much for your time and for your insight. Always great to have you here.
Thanks.
That's Kerry Severino. And I got to take a short pause, as you know. Come back. I want to share something with you. Of course, we'll pray the chaplet coming up at 3 as well, or at 3 Central, I should say. So be sure and join me for that. Kerry, by the way, is chief counsel for the Judicial Crisis Network and a former clerk of Justice Clarence Thomas. Great conversation. Be right back. Catholic Order of Foresters is proud to sponsor the Relevant Radio Studio line. For information about employment opportunities and flexible premium life insurance plans, visit relevantradio.com/Forester.
The Chaplet of Divine Mercy begins soon on Relevant Radio.
Well, thanks for tuning in. Let's pray, okay? We'll do that in just a few moments here. I always enjoy spending time with you doing that. And if you have a special need, I'll give you the number. Do me a favor, call one other person and invite them to pray with us as well. The number here is 888-914-9149. Maybe they're having a difficulty with their health or their business, or they're facing some sort of financial or legal challenge. Say, hey, I know you might not be listening, but we're going to get together in about 10 minutes. They can listen at relevantradio.com. Stream it on the website. They could use the mobile app. And if you don't have the app, I really want to encourage you to download it. It's a great, great tool. Prayers and streaming and access to a whole lot of great things. So great articles. Go to your Google Play or to your Apple Store and you can download it. Just type in Relevant Radio. Or on the station you're listening to, you can get plugged in. I want to talk about suffering for just a moment, because I've been doing some suffering. And I don't like to talk about it publicly, because I think you lose the merit or the grace that you sometimes can get. I think if we suffer silently and quietly, I think it's a good thing. I've been broadcasting remotely the past 2 days because I was in the studio with Maggie on Thursday, and the broadcast was over and the show's over. You know, we write our promo for the next day and we get ready to cut and record that. And as I was done getting ready to take off after the broadcast to head home, as I got out of my chair, something strange happened. I got this terrible searing pain just ran up my lower back, and I could barely stand up. I've never had any real issues before. Only one time have I ever had an encounter, and I could barely walk. So Maggie and another colleague of mine, Matt, they had to walk me to my car, could barely get in it. When I pulled home and got into my garage, I had to call my wife on my cell phone. Hey, I can't get out of the car, help. And I've just been in a lot of pain. And I've been contemplating suffering, and I want to address it for a minute. Years ago, I was struck with this same ailment. It was probably a decade ago. And I didn't understand where it came from or what happened. I didn't lift anything heavy. I wasn't in a car accident. Did I just turn the wrong way? Or was it something more? Was it a gift from God? Was my suffering a gift? And the reason I say that is I was in so much pain, I couldn't lay on a couch. I couldn't sit in a chair. I could barely walk. I was like an old man. So I go to my physician. They x-ray me. They don't see anything wrong. Pain persists. It gives me stretching exercises. What, anti-inflammatory still? Then they say, well, come back. We'll give you an MRI. They do this, you know, intense MRI. Nothing wrong, right? They can't find anything. Sends me to somebody else. I don't know who it was. The next doctor up, I don't know, whatever this third doctor was. And in the middle of the exam, he stops. He says, are you under any pressure? You know, is there anything going on in your life? And I'm like, it's not in my head. This is not in my head. This is real. You think I'd be here if I wasn't in agony? This is debilitating. And all the while, when I was suffering, I offered it up for somebody who was in really a bad way. I mean, they were in a terrible, terrible way. And I said, Lord, take my suffering. I don't understand where it came from or what happened, and use it, right? So I would say probably for 10 weeks, maybe 12 weeks, I suffered. And I was in agony. I mean, it was debilitating. And I was praying for this person. And I'll tell you what, the fruit of that suffering was off the charts. You might be going through chronic migraines now, or you might have arthritis, you might have back pain, you might be sick from your chemo. You know, you might have a ruptured disc or suffer sciatica, whatever your ailment is right now. I want to talk to you about it, because it's meritorious. It's meritorious. God will never try us beyond what we're able to suffer. He'll never do that. I prayed for this person for 12 consecutive weeks, and then a miracle unfolded. This person found a liberation. They found a conversion from the issue that had just ensnared them and that was leading them down a pathway that led to doom. It led them to doom. As mysteriously as this ailment came on, it's not just a week where, okay, it's some inflammation, the inflammation goes down, you're better. This went on for almost 3 months. It disappeared just as quickly as it came on, just as quickly as it came on. And I think about what St. Faustina says. She says, suffering is the greatest treasure on earth. It purifies the soul. And in suffering, we learn who our true friend is. That's Jesus Christ, right? That's Jesus Christ. She would pray to the Lord. Lord, she would say, you know, thank you for these torments. You know, no one will understand, you know, but it drew her closer to him. And the Lord gave her to understand in the midst of her agony what unimaginable glory awaits the person who takes the suffering and unites it to that of Christ on the cross, who resembles the suffering of Jesus. The Lord promised, he says, that person will resemble Jesus in his glory, and that God the Father, the creator of all things, our eternal Father, he'll recognize and glorify your soul to the extent that he sees in you the resemblance of his Son. So Faustina came to understand this, that Jesus, in granting us this ability to suffer, is giving us this great blessing. She says, oh, if people only knew this, if people could understand the value of suffering, oh my God, she writes in her diary, if I were thereby able to attain just one degree more, I would gladly suffer all the torments of the martyrs put together. If she could know God one degree more, one degree closer in heaven. She goes, there's a great difference in the depth of knowledge and encounter when we cross to the other side, when we're with God for all eternity. She says, there's this great difference in depth and knowledge of God between one degree and another. And she was willing to suffer all the martyrdoms, all the pain, all the agony of all the martyrs put together if she could move one degree closer in that encounter with God the Father. So I say to you, if you're suffering, suffer well. Suffer well. She says, if only the suffering soul knew how much they were loved by God, if you knew it, you would die of joy and excessive happiness. And someday we'll know. Someday you'll know the value of what you're going through right now, but you're going to no longer be able to suffer. So this is the present moment. So as I'm in this agony right now, and again, it came on quite unexpectedly. There'll be a very logical explanation for it. Whether it did or not, whether it'll disappear just as miraculously as the other case did, I know it's meritorious. And I'm using this. I'm actually rejoicing in my discomfort. I am finding joy in my agony. And I am thanking God for this ability to suffer. Because as Faustina says, one day we will no longer be able to suffer. And if you only knew how loved you were by God, you would die of joy and excessive. Someday you'll know. And when that day comes, you're going to be no longer able to suffer. So maybe you have a broken heart. Maybe you're distressed over that child. Maybe you're suffering in your relationship. Maybe you're suffering physically or financially. We suffer in different ways. There's all sorts of crosses. I say to you, embrace it. Unite your suffering to that of the Lord. You'll find joy and you'll find freedom in that. And you will see the fruit of that. You will see the power, the efficacy of taking what you're going through right now and giving it to the Lord. You're going to see that. You know, Lord put it on my heart. You know, he told Faustina, she recorded in her diary one place. She says, you'll save more souls through your prayer and your suffering, through your prayer and your suffering, than a missionary will through teachings and sermons alone. So pray for that soul that's away from the faith. All right, that wayward child. And rejoice, because God's given you a gift. All right, we'll pray together when I return.